And we have a good number of items on the agenda tonight. So, Alan, take it away for tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And actually, our first item is a follow-up from Chris.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Sorry. I was looking through on the stuff I had to paste into the chat, but there's nothing for this one. So back in, looks like August 10th of this year at Q&A, I had a presentation, mini presentation on data breach that had been reported at a particular site. And Have I Been Pwned informed me of this. And so I thought, well, I don't really know these people, but what's it all about? So I did a little bit of investigation into it. And so the URL for that is at the on the slide. Next. So at the end of all of that, I thought that it might not actually be the final word because there's some back and forth, but they did say that thank you for your response, and you know, we're gonna take care of all of this. Next. So I figured, don't trust them as far as you can throw them, because I just got an email the other day from that company saying that in July I signed onto their platform and can they help me with services and things like that. And next. So I replied to them and said the only reason why I was on their site at all, and I didn't actually sign in. What I did was I tried to do a password recovery on it, on my email address, and it told me, oh, we don't have an account in that name, so I was happy. So I didn't actually do a sign in, but I told this guy, I said the only reason why I was involved at this, your site at all again, was to try to make sure that you purged any information that you had about me on your site. Next. And then the person replied saying that it only affected certain people who were on certain licenses and I'm safe. And so I should feel warm and fuzzy all about that. Next.
And it's being dealt with.
And it's being dealt with. That's right. Next. So do I really believe that all my data has been purged from their systems? I kind of doubt it because this guy somehow got in touch with me. So they still know about me somehow. So I kind of doubt that the data has been purged, but quite frankly, I don't think there's anything more I can do about it. So I thought it was just interesting as a follow-up here, just to show you that some companies are not as forthcoming or as complete in what they tell you they're going to do and what they actually follow through with. Hopefully, there'll be no personal data that I have that will be put at risk.
Okay, so the next thing we have is a computer basics item, and you'll notice here I've said it's not so computer basics, and the only reason for that, it's actually a very simple process. The only reason I say it's not so basic is because it does need an edit made to the registry. But Chris had told us how to do registry edits a long time ago and how to back things up before you start. And Tom did one, I think, last week where he went through the process. So it's actually really easy. Anyway, I'll give you all the steps, and if you're interested, you can take a look. But basically, it's the lock screen. I never understood why Windows has a lock screen. When I dual boot in Linux, Linux goes straight to the login screen, and I just enter my password, and I'm in. In Windows, it always brings up the pretty picture, and then you have to blow that screen away, and then it gives you the login screen. All right, so that's fine. So I thought, well, I wonder if you can get rid of the lock screen. And sure enough, if you go on to Mr. Google and ask him, how do you get rid of the lock screen, and you'll find at least this hit from How to Geek, which tells you how to get rid of the lock screen, and you notice that it does need this edit to the registry. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through the edit step by step. And if all you want to do is remove the lock screen, then this is the process to do it. So first of all, you have to run regedit as an administrator. So you get elevated privileges to edit the registry. And then you have to navigate, and you have to go to the local machine, software, policies, Microsoft, and Windows. And then you'll end up down here in this Windows key here. So now what you do now is you right click on Windows and you select New and then select a new key. So we're going to create a key under this Windows area, and we're going to call it Personalization. So here you can see I've changed the name of the new key and I've called it Personalization. Right, so now we've got the key, we right-click on the key. When we right-click on the key, then we can select New again, and this time we want to select a D word, a 32-bit D word. And again, we're going to rename this new D word as No Lock Screen. So here you can see I've edited the D word as No Lock Screen. So now we've got the new key, new D word. We can double click on the No Lock Screen. That will pop up this dialog box. And what we need to do is set this value here to 1, because that basically turns this thing on. So now once we've done that, we can just select OK, close RegEdit by hitting the red X in the corner here. And now we have to restart the computer. And when we restart the computer, lo and behold, it goes straight to the login window. I can enter my password and I'm straight into Windows. So it certainly has got rid of the lock screen, for which I am wholly grateful. So if you're interested in doing that, that's how you do it. And the slides will be on the deck and all the steps are there. So it should be just follow the bouncing ball and it will work like clockwork.
Tom has a comment. He says, you can specify what the lock screen looks like with your choice of picture. And I'd like to comment to that. If that's all you want to do is have your own picture, I agree with Alan. Do away with the lock screen altogether. Why not just go to the sign in screen? However, I'd like to do a counter argument saying that the lock screen, I actually like it. The photography that Microsoft pushes out to you is actually pretty stunning photography. And if you move your mouse around, usually what you'll do is it'll come up with a little bit of text. And if you click on that, you then get the login screen. And once you log in, unfortunately, it'll be Edge will load with more information about that particular site, or it might be a quiz or something like that. So I find the lock screen stuff is actually kind of fun. But I totally sympathize with anybody who doesn't agree with me on that. And Alan's tip will certainly allow you to bypass that completely.
And I haven't found the RegEdit to get rid of Edge yet, but one of these things. Okay, moving along, Chris has a share for us on safe browsing.
Yeah, so Google has come out with this thing they're calling Enhanced Safe Browsing for your Google account. It's not specifically to your browser or any of the other, Google properties or whatever. It specifically revolves around your account. And the way they describe it is you get faster, more proactive protection against dangerous websites, downloads, and extensions when you're signed in. And so it sounds like a pretty good thing. So I decided to take it for a spin and see what it would do for me. So next. So you go to that website and you get this take action. And I say kudos to Google. They actually had a clickable URL in the email itself, but if you just clicked on the take action, but they also just gave the text to it. So those people who have been taught don't click on things in email, they do have the link there that they can select the link and paste it into a browser. So good on Google for doing that. So that takes you to a site, and it tells you that this enhanced safe browsing works automatically for faster proactive protection against dangerous websites, downloads, and extensions. So it sounds pretty good. So it says it keeps you safe while you're signed in and improves your security in Google Chrome and in Gmail itself. So all sounds like really good stuff. So next. So on that same page, there are expandable sections that will give you information on exactly what the safe browsing, enhanced safe browsing uses, how the function actually uses that information and how it helps with your security. So if you're unsure about it, and you can browse a little bit deeper onto it to see whether it's actually going to do stuff for you rather than for Google. Next. So I look at this as just being yet another tool in your safety toolbox. All the security on computers is, generally speaking, it's a layered approach to things, so that if one layer fails you, hopefully another layer will protect you. So this is just another layer of protection that's available to you at no cost. Next. So if you go to, if you want to turn this on manually rather than going through their prompts and so forth, you go to myaccount.google.com/security and you scroll down that page and you'll find the enhanced safe browsing for your account and you just toggle it on. Next. And then it'll come up and it'll say, well, do you really want this? I guess. And yes, turn it on. And then you'll get another prompt saying what this enhanced safe browsing is actually going to do. And again, I'll say, yes, really, really do want this. Turn it on. And then you finally get a prompt saying that it is now turned on. So thanks very much, Google. I haven't noticed anything that is different on my browsing, but hopefully it is offering some level of protection. Next. And then I get this pop-up as part of the Windows notification asking me if I want to turn on enhanced browsing. And it says, you've turned it on in your account, now get it for Chrome. So you can click there, and it'll actually enable it within the Chrome browser as well as just on your account itself. And I think that's it. Oh, some final thoughts, yeah. So there are things within security that it's a double-edged sword. So in almost all cases, actually hit next, Alan. In almost all cases, you'll find that when you get added security, you will end up with some trade-off that you have to give. In this case, there may be some privacy implications for it. So Google tells you exactly what's going to go on. So it's going to send the URLs from Chrome and Google Apps to their servers to check them out. So if you're concerned about the fact that Google is going to know a little bit more about your browsing habits and things like that, maybe you don't want to turn it on. But if I look at it this way, I say, would you rather let Google know what you're up to or a hacker? Because if your account gets hacked and enhanced safe browsing might have protected you, you know, the hacker is going to know what you're up to. And I would rather Google know what I'm up to than a hacker. So when it comes to security, I'm willing personally to give up a little bit of that privacy or potential privacy issues and things like that in order to get that extra security layer on my computer. Your mileage may vary, and certainly it's up to you to make that assessment yourself.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Something for everybody to think about. And here's something else for you to think about or maybe take a look at. I put this in the user forum, but if anybody didn't see that and is interested in the history of USBs, this is a super little video from Chris Barnett at Explaining Computers on his YouTube channel, and he talks about all the different variants on USB, from 1.0 to the latest and greatest USB 4 and beyond. One of the interesting things he has is an example for USB OTG on-the-go cables. If you read about on-the-go, it always says that it's for connecting devices that connect as a host or a peripheral. And the example is a digital camera, which is actually quite neat. So if you connect your camera to a printer and have the camera fire off images so that the printer can print them, then the camera is basically acting as the host and giving the commands, and the dumb printer at the other end is just responding to that. Whereas if you connect the camera to a computer, then the computer basically acts as the host, and the camera looks like a storage device. So it's acting as a kind of a disk peripheral, if you like. So the OTG cable basically sorts out all the electronics and makes that host peripheral deal basically work. And if you thought you knew everything about USBs, and he said he gave a simple explanation of everything, but if you read the USB 3 stuff, it's really quite complicated how USB 3 changed over time. And then you might be interested in what is the DP variant, and also the latest version is a PD variant. So if you don't know what they are, then maybe take a look at that video. It's actually quite useful. Okay, moving along. Chris has a share, and he wants us to switch browsers, I think.
Well, I don't know if I want people to switch browsers, but I came across this, which I thought was kind of cool. I think everybody has probably come across this, where, especially lately, where you get this cookie consent banner popping up on every website. And basically you have to either agree to it or, you know, it's very hard to just dismiss it. So generally speaking, you have to say that you accept them all, or you can go in and you might be able to accept only essential cookies for website, and so forth. So, I think this, actually there's another nuance to this. As I say, it's talking mostly in response to the GDPR in the European Union. It is also another part of that, or a subset of that, I guess, that it really is in response to, and that'll come up later on. Alan has some slides. So next. So Brave came out with this statement saying that, you know, they didn't think this was a really good thing. And one of the things that they claimed was that many cookie consent systems are actually tracking users, and it's introducing the harm that the consent system was supposed to protect against. And the URL to that notice is there, and it's in the chat as well. Next. So, they have this new availability. It's available in the Brave nightly builds, so they're test versions of Brave, and it's supposed to be released to the general user of, or anybody gets a regular update to Brave, starting sometime this month in version 1.45. And if you go to the settings, the hamburger menu, and you go to settings, next, and then you go down to shields, and then you scroll down on that page, you'll see block cookies section, and there's content filtering. You click on that, next, and then you'll get the filter list, and if you scroll down that part, there will be a cookies as an, or you type in cookies in the filter list, and it will come up with the one filter list called easy list, cookie list, and you select that, and you click on Save Changes. Next. And then beforehand, if you went to this Axel Springer site, you got the cookie consent form. Afterwards, next, you will just get the site without the consent form. Now, my understanding is that this actually says, basically, it does not consent to any of the cookies, so you're not potentially leaving yourself to any additional, you know, whatever you might think of about cookies, you're not going to be setting it to allow more cookies than you already had in your browser. And next. So there are some other options for blocking cookie consent banners. The most common is to use a browser extension. And I have on the slide there four that are based for any Chromium-based browser. So that's Chrome, Edge, there's a whole bunch of Brave, there's a whole bunch of browsers that are Chromium-based, and so there are a number of them there. Note that on the first one, the way it works is that it automatically accepts all cookies, so it just doesn't bug you, but it'll accept them all. The other ones will actually block the cookies themselves. And I think that's, oh yeah, fly in the ointment, yeah. So a fly in the ointment on all of this is that Google actually wants to make changes to how the web operates, or client software, web browsers actually work on the web. And they actually want to make it more difficult to actually block cookie banners or to filter out unwanted web content, such as videos, ads, and so forth, tracking scripts. They want to make it easier for sites to evade content blockers. They want to remove capabilities from any of the privacy-protecting browser extensions and give users less control over how we experience the web using, you know, the browsers, in particular, Google Chrome. So why do they want to do this? Next. Well, long and short of it really is that Google is an advertising company. Next. I went on to find out how much money actually is made by Google from advertising, and I thought this was ironic that, you know, I ended up using Google Chrome. I actually had a Google or a cookie consent banner block the information that I actually wanted on the page. Next. But if I went with the Brave browser, I didn't get that. So that was kind of cool. And I saw that, in fact, in 2021, Google made $209 billion U.S. from advertising, and it's actually 81.3% of all their revenues. So that's why Google actually does not want you blocking ads and various things like that that will harm their business. So that's all I have to say on that, really, is that I think that the Brave browser is not a bad choice, and I may come back with another share that I have about Brave that really makes it apparent how much tracking is going on and on the web. So that might be for another week, and I highly encourage anybody to take a look at the Brave browser, but if you want that cookie consent form blocking, you can get it on any Chromium browser by going with a an extension. And I think Alan now has some information on that front.
Or Firefox.
Sorry, what was that?
Or Firefox.
Sure.
Yeah, so I was kind of interested in this this process. It's for me, it's another one of these screen pop-ups that is just annoying and you have to click to make it go away. I actually did a little research on the what they call the cookie law, which isn't really a law. It turns out it's part of the European Union. It's called an e-privacy directive. And basically what it does is it requires user consent, and as it says here, to store or retrieve any information on a computer, smartphone, or tablet. And you have to provide clear and comprehensive information about cookies and trackers. And sorry, Mr. Google, but if the European Union go one step further and make this into a regulation, all countries will have to sign on to it, and it will then become law. And part of it is the right to refuse cookies. So it's going to be burnt into the EU law, I imagine. So the one I took a look at Chris's list, and I didn't like the one that said, the first one that said it accepts all the cookies. So I took a look at this notice blocker, and I installed it on my Chromium-based browser, which is actually Vivaldi. And you'll notice in the top right-hand corner, there it is as the add-in, and it's already blocked some cookies for me. And it actually has a bunch of options. You can turn things on and off, and you can whitelist things and all kinds of stuff. But I didn't bother with any of that. I just tried it to see what would happen. And basically, I went to a couple of European sites because that's where you have to put up this banner. So here is the actual European Union official website. And sure enough, when you load the page, if you don't have the cookie notice installed, notice here it's turned off or it's not installed, then sure enough you get this banner down here, and you have to accept all, or you can accept only the essential ones, and then of course you've got to figure out what you need to do there. However, if you turn on the cookie blocker, and load the website, you'll see that there is no cookie banner pop-up. So for that site, at least, it works really well. And then I went to Euro NCAP, which is a crash test site, new car assessment program. And sure enough, it pops up the banner. But you notice this one's actually quite intelligent. Now, this is, if I was going to do a cookie banner, this is how I would do it. Don't show this message again. I mean, give me a cookie, but then don't bother asking me in future. Anyway, there it is without the cookie notice installed. And then if I install cookie notice over here, you see that it pops up without the banner. One thing it doesn't do, however, if you go and look at something like the BBC or the Guardian, here's the Guardian newspaper in the UK, it does pop up this please send money pop-up. And even with the cookie, this is the without cookie notice installed. And if I install cookie notice, then you'll see I get exactly the same web page. And it doesn't stop these begging pop-ups. But that's not a cookie notice banner, so I guess that's acceptable. Anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting. So if you want to give that thing a whirl, they're free extensions. If they don't work, you just uninstall it and everything's back to normal. Okay, so we're about that time where we're going to turn it over to Lawrence, who's going to go into part three of Sweet Home 3D and share his screen.
Indeed, I'm ready to do so. So hello, folks. So thanks to the dutiful work of my partner in crime, John Gingerich, we put together this series of videos that basically will show off the end product. And as per what we promised earlier, we wanted to give you a flair of what it is that Sweet Home 3D, or as I like to call it, 3D, will provide. Then the next time we're around, I want you to leave that on now, but anyways, never mind. So the purpose of today is to provide the end result. Not as good as what you see on the screen here, but this is something that John has put together, and I'm just very happy to get be the part of narrating it. So without further ado, and all right, here we go. So now, of course, Windows blocking my script, don't you know? All right, so we're going to start off with the human user interface. Guess human user, whatever. And so first thing we have is the upper left, which allows us to show the furniture, fixtures, and so forth. As you can see, we can expand this, and we have a large number of fixtures. And, you know, in my limited use of Sweet Home, a lot of times this gives you enough to get you by. There's also the ability to provide for additional things. Then on the lower left is the actual inventory that you use. And that has the advantage of giving you the details of each one of the devices. So as we're showing here, the side entrance, both from the 2D and the 3D perspective. At the upper right, we have the 2D model. And as you can see, John is now showing you what it's like to remove and put back in, or visibly show the door and put it back. And as you can see with the 2D, you can move it around. And basically, you have an aerial perspective of what's available, including the ability to zoom in and out so that you can get at the detail that you want. And then next is the lower right, which is the 3D part. And that allows you to, I get an almost lifelike view of what's going on. Now watch as John moves the chair. And as you can see in the 3D model, the chair is moving. It's almost like a ghost, right? And as he puts it back. So that gives you an idea of the user interface. On to the viewing options. So in this, we're going to show some of the boundary lines, which is important, especially depending on what monitor type you're working with. But as you can see here, we have the ability to expand the 3D model and decrease it as we see fit. Same thing with the 2D, so we can move that around. It gives you the flexibility of working even with a small screen, though, you know, like any CAD drawing, I wouldn't recommend it. You then have the ability to take the 3D model and present it as a separate window, giving you a little bit more flexibility on how you're viewing the various components as you're working away through it. Now, the thing that we want to note here is that the 3D model doesn't have a quote-unquote full screen, but you can easily get around that by adjusting it, as you see here. Okay, all right, moving on. Manipulating furniture. With the furniture, we're going to show you how to move stuff around. So we're going to look at the couch. Now watch both the 2D and the 3D. And as John moves it around, he's showing you how to actually move the couch around. Now, as you can see, other objects don't interfere with you moving it. So that can be a plus or a minus depending on how you feel about that. But I think for most of us, you know, we would like the ability to be able to move. Now we are showing you how to delete. And as you can see, we deleted the couch. Now we've moved over the single seater. We're pivoting it around using the controls with the mouse and adjusting it accordingly. And then we use Control Z to put everything back to the way it was. On to navigation. So with the navigation, we are showing how we would use the mouse, which we both agree that's typically the best way to do it. And as you can see, as we're using the mouse here, we're panning around back and forth. We can also pan or zoom in as we're doing now. And you may want to notice the little figure on the right-hand side. Sorry, folks. Oh, geez, I did something. One moment, please. That teaches me for using the mouse. There we go. We're back to business. So anyways, let's put the mouse back so I'm not manipulating. And then now John's showing us how we can use the pointers at the top left of the screen to zoom in and out or backwards or side to side as he clicks. So if you want a finer movement with using the mouse, you can use that tool as well. And you can see in the middle there, we can move this perspective up and down. Now we're going to show you the avatar. And as you can see, as we move the avatar around, we're actually changing the perspective of how we're viewing the 3D side of things. And in a moment, John's going to position which way we're looking at and walk through to another room. So you get this. This is also very important, especially when you're setting up, because there's sometimes that Sweet Home 3D doesn't get right. And at this point, this is where you want to do the walkthroughs and see whether this makes sense or not. I.e., you know, if you position a window on a wall, you want to make sure that it does make sense, because sometimes Sweet Home 3D will, in fact, make its own decision, and you'll have to you have to fiddle with it. But as you can see here, we are moving the avatar around, and this allows us to change our perspective of the floor, ceiling, and all the fixtures that we have in our house. Okay, now Google, now Zoom's getting in the way. One moment, folks. All right. Now we're going to do the aerial view. And with the aerial view, as you again guess from the title, allows you to see the perspective from if you were driving a drone. So by going in and selecting the aerial view, as we just did, it then changes our perspective. We're going to resize the window so that we have more a larger view of it. And by zooming in and out, you get the idea of being able to see the whole house. And you can see also that at the top there, we actually have a picnic bench at the side of the house there, outside of the house. And by pivoting around, we have the ability, either with using the mouse alone or by using the controls on the top left, to manipulate how we want to view our home, so to speak. And as you can see, we're going back and forth, and we're rotating using the X and Y axis. Again, this is very important. I know this was helpful in me trying to figure out position of windows and so forth as I try to figure out, what it literally is, the ground floor. Finally, we're going to show the virtual tour. Now, in setting up the virtual tour, we're going to position the avatar in such a way that we want to set up the process. And then we are going to start by preparing a video of how we're moving through. Now, as we watch here, John's going ahead. And again, we're going to set it up with a separate window, so get a perspective on things. And now, as you can see, we've clicked on create the video. And by clicking on the video, we are going to use the red dot there. And just watch how John uses his mouse to indicate where he's going to position things. So the other point to this is the video format and the quality. You want to pick it that works with your machine. Obviously, if you pick a higher resolution, it's going to take up more power, and you could end up waiting hours to do this. Now, what John has done here, this took him 5 minutes once he did the walkthrough. And as you can see here, he's manipulating the avatar. And just watch this for a moment, folks, as keeps on clicking on the red button, and you'll see the results of the red button being clicked in just a moment. I'll let this show. I'll let this show you what is going on. Okay, and then he picks the red button. Now, look at the end result here is that you now have a plot of how the person moved within the house. Now we're creating the video, and you can see here that this is it performing the video creation, and as pointed out, it took about more than 5 minutes. We saved the file. And then the end result is what you're seeing right now. So, and this the, so when the next, when we come back, it will be 3 weeks, there will be but towards the end of October, we're going to start the process from scratch. You now see what we can create. The next step, and at this point, Alan, I'm going to give the control back to you, or if you wouldn't mind taking control, please.
Actually, a couple of questions for you.
Right. Just put up your screen share, please. Then I'll be able to answer the questions. Thank you. All right. Program give cost estimates to labor and materials. Oh, that's a good question, Tom. I don't know. I think it, I know that it's gotten rave review from realtors and so forth. Is it enough to give you labor and material costs? That I would believe that that would be something that you would export the data into Excel to do that. Can you make the chair float? I'm not sure what you mean by floating.
I think the next thing Tom put in makes the point. Can you move things in the y-axis? So a TV mounted on the wall sort of idea.
Oh, well, the avatar is always standing. So there's a limit. So you would be wanting to do that as if the avatar was sitting down in the couch. And I think that's, I don't think it's built to handle that.
Well, are you sure? Because if you have a window, presumably you can place the, you know, how high the window is in the room, right? So this would just be another object like a window that you would place 4 feet above the floor or something like that.
Yeah, but I don't think you can change the perspective of the avatar.
No, I think he's wondering about having your actual objects. Can they move in the Z-axis?
You can do that for windows and so forth. I would imagine you could do that for TVs, though I'm not sure. That's something we'd have to try.
Okay.
Does it work with a touchscreen tablet? Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking, I don't know if there's an Android version of this or an iOS version. But I do know that it works with Linux and app and Mac as well as Windows. So if they have the touch capability, then yes, I would say that it would work for that. And can you put textures and patterns on surfaces? Yes, you can. Though I haven't tried it yet.
Okay, I think that was it for the questions, Lance. So I guess we'll look forward to your next session.
Thank you.
That was great, Lars.
And John, thanks very much to the two of
you. Yeah. Pass on. Thanks there, too.
Okay, so next up is part four, I think it is, of Bob Walker's Microsoft Store series. So, Bob, are you going to share your screen?
Yeah, here we go. And do you see the start screen there?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, great. Okay, so let's get started. This session is, we're going to look at some great Microsoft Store apps for Windows 10. And so far in this series, we've looked at what is the Microsoft Store, desktop apps versus Microsoft Store apps. We had two sessions on that. And this is the last session here, part four, some great Microsoft Store apps for Windows 10. Just a reminder that depending on who you listen to, the term Microsoft Store apps can refer to any app from the Microsoft Store or UWP app from the Microsoft Store. For the sake of consistency and clarity, in this series of presentations, the term Microsoft Store apps will refer to any app from the Microsoft Store unless otherwise advised. And the UWP will specifically refer to a unified Windows platform app from the store. Now, most of the info from this session came from these two articles. And at the end of the deck, there's a couple slides on with the URLs for all this stuff. So if you download the deck later, you'll get all this info. Both of the articles focus mainly on apps based on the Universal Windows platform, and we covered that a couple of sessions ago. Keep in mind that the Universal Windows platform versions of many apps are optimized for use with a touch screen and don't really work as well with a mouse. For most of these apps, you can download the Windows desktop version from the app's own website and sometimes from the Microsoft Store. The Android version you can download from the Google Play Store for your smartphones or your Android tablets. And the Mac, iOS, and iPad OS versions you can get from the Apple App Store. So the first app we're going to look at is Evernote Touch. This is a cross-platform note-taking app. It lets you save notes, pictures, videos, and you can synchronize them across multiple platforms, like, for example, your desktop, your tablet, your smartphone, etc. And it lets you take give you access to your notes, ideas, and important information from anywhere you've got a data connection. Users can organize their notes and files into notebooks for handy access, while tags let you quickly search for keywords. Another note-taking and to-do list app is Wunderlist. It delivers some great features for free and the premium users alike. This is a freemium app that lets you get the basic functionality for free, and you get the good stuff if you cough up some bucks. And I'm not sure off the top of my head how much the premium version costs. It's a very nimble and efficient task listing app, and it's equally at home with simple grocery lists all the way up to detailed daily itineraries and project work assignments. So in a way, it's a project management app light. Users can share lists with friends and colleagues. They can attach photos and files. You can set custom reminders, and you can organize all your tasks and notes. Flipboard sort of takes the Windows 8 and Windows 10 home screen to the next level. It's a classic. It's a feed reader, and it gives a highly visual magazine-like spin. You can subscribe to a variety of categories through their website, or check off your favorite websites. And Flipboard presents you with a personalized magazine with all the content you're looking for. So you're not held hostage to whatever Microsoft wants you to see. The app allows you to add your own newsfeed content, as well as browse through custom reading lists made up by other Flipboard users. In addition to news stories and articles, you can connect with your favorite social networks, such as Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, in order to view your social media streams from within the app. Flipboard aggregates the content from social media, news feeds, photo sharing sites, and other websites, and presents it in a magazine-like format and allows users to flip through the articles, images, and videos being shared. So the readers can also save their own stories into the Flipboard magazines and allow for some access by other users to your stuff. Dropbox is one of the really great apps. It's a go-to solution for many people's online storage and sharing needs. Dropbox is basically a web locker for all your files, your documents, your photos, and all sorts of other data you can access from anywhere. And as well, you can download any of the content for offline access. Dropbox is a great way to share files for collaboration and to upload new material. But the real biggie here for most of us is that Dropbox allows you to send files that are too big for email. So if you have a 2 or 3 gig file that you want to send to a friend or a business associate, you can't send that by email. Dropbox is the ideal solution to that. We covered this last session, and this is VLC Media Player. VLC is one of the really great all-in-one media players. It'll play just about anything you throw at it, from audio to video files, and it will handle a lot of trickier formats such as OGG, FLAC, and MKV without a lot of fuss and muss. And it allows you to do a lot of configuring of the application. Now, version you get, the Universal Windows Platform version, has limited functionality, and the user interface is quite simplified. So power users will probably want to use the desktop version on their computers instead of the UWP version. An Android version is available from the Google Play Store, and Mac, iOS, and iPadOS versions are available from the Apple App Store. And this picture here shows the desktop version of the app. Adobe Photoshop Express is one of the ones that both the articles recommend. Now, sometimes you don't need a cutting-edge, really complex photo editing suite when all you want to do is clear up some red eye and punch up some colors. And Adobe Photoshop Express serves this entry-level niche quite well. And it provides useful photo editing features packed into a free app. Now, if you go to the full version of Adobe Photoshop, it's breathtakingly expensive and incredibly complex to use. So this is the best of that world. Now that said, UrfanView, which has been demoed for us several times over the years, mainly by Chris and a couple times by myself, as it has evolved, does most of the same basic photo editing just as well for the same price, which is free. As well, Linda and Chris have done some great presentations over the last year or two on other great photo editing apps. So if you have nothing else, Adobe Photoshop Express is pretty good and basic. And if you think you might want to upgrade in the future to the full-fledged version, it's a way to get your feet wet. Khan Academy aims to provide a world-class education for anyone, anywhere. They host literally thousands of free online tutorial videos for a wide variety of subjects, from biology, chemistry, physics, kindergarten to grade 12 mathematics, history, civics, computer programming, all sorts of stuff, and it's all free. They have an adaptive testing system that allows learners to practice at their own pace, and they have statistics tracking and a badge system that provides helpful metrics as well as a gamified element for learning. That a lot of the kids will really like, and it allows them to see where they are. I highlighted this, the Khan Academy, because it's a great not-for-profit site. Now, That said, you may want to go directly to their website instead of using the Microsoft Store app. And if you go to the website, it has lots of resources, not just for the students, but for the teachers and the parents as well. TuneIn Radio, if you heard all that saying that radio is dead, you haven't been listening to TuneIn Radio. It gives you access to more than 60,000 radio stations worldwide, as well as millions of on-demand programs and podcasts. You can search for a wide variety of content, including your local radio stations, favorite artists, teams, comedians, talk show hosts, sports events and everything. You can go to big name channels like ESPN, BBC, and CBS. An additional neat feature for the app is the ability to pin your favorite channels to the start menu for easy access. And you can access some of the TuneIn Radio's features through your Amazon Alexa or Amazon Echo devices and Google Home. And our built-in expert on this is our good friend Bob Harris, who's presented on a couple of subjects before. So I first learned about this app actually at his place. Another app is OneDrive. Now, you can access OneDrive through Windows 10 directly, and it's Microsoft's flagship cloud service, cloud storage service. But for the people who don't want to deal with the Microsoft somewhat fiddly desktop folder, this app is a great simplified alternative. The top of my screen is blocked off here because of Zoom here, but this app, this recipe profiler, displays nutritional information for existing recipes or any recipes you create. It works offline and features a database of over 12,000 food types. So you can load a recipe in and get some great nutritional information on it. It's a great way to find out just what foods in your diet are healthy and where you can make improvements. Another recipe app is Recipe Keeper. It's a recipe organizer, a shopping list manager, and a meal planner. You can add and organize your own creations and import recipes from external sites. You can also add ingredients to a shopping list directly from your recipes with a single click. And at some point in the future, I'm going to look at some of these recipe type apps because that's an interest of mine. I've tried some in the past and they haven't really worked for me, but these two look pretty good. Fresh Paint is a neat painting app. You can use a mouse or a touch screen, and if you use a touch screen, you can use a stylus. It mimics the effects of a paintbrush on the surface, and it has blending effects, a virtual palette for mixing colors. You can start from scratch, or you can color in existing photos and templates. There's a variety of paid and free art packs you can add with additional features and images to paint. So I'm just about finished here. The two articles I mentioned at the start of the presentation features many, many more apps you might want to check out than I've had the time to cover here. Keep in mind that many of the apps that they cover are basically a wrapper or a portal with just some of the features of the website. For example, they have an Amazon app. You don't get the full functionality you would if you went directly to the Amazon site. So in these cases, you might want to go directly to the site itself. And if any of you use any apps that you find really useful that other members might be interested in, feel free to give a short presentation during one of our Q&A sessions. If you want to do that, send an email to suggestion box at opcug.ca. And this ends our look at the Microsoft Store. There's two slides here of the various URLs mentioned in this series, and I'm sure by now Chris has them posted in the chat.
Yep, they're all there.
And that's it for tonight. And I think we have a few minutes left for any other questions.
One of the questions was from Tom. Are any UWP programs that are unique or better than standard apps for the desktop or laptop?
I'm not fully knowledgeable in that area, but most of the UWP apps are designed to be used on multiple platforms, including apps with small screens and that. So in general, the desktop versions for power users are more appropriate, and the Android and the iOS versions are suitable for a small screen, as well as the Universal Windows platform apps. So it's up to you. If you see an app and you just want to use a couple of features for something, the Universal Windows platform version is great. But if you're any kind of power user, you want to get the best of all the features, the desktop app is the best. Some of the desktop versions are available from the Microsoft Store. Otherwise, you might have to go to the app's own website or another app provider website.
Certainly, there are some apps that are only available as UWP. A good example of that is Linda's favorite photo editor, Photoscape X. It is only available as a UWP app. They have an older version that is still available of Photoscape, non-X version, that is available as a Win32 app, desktop app. Another one, probably my favorite UWP app, is the Windows Weather app. Comes built into Windows, but it is a UWP app, and to me, it's one of the best weather apps that is out there. It's quite a good program, and I suspect there are probably others that are available only as UWP.
Well, as Bob says, if anybody knows what they are, send us a note and we'll have you present it to the group. How's that? Okay, we're just a few minutes over time, so I'm going to wrap up by sharing my screen and reminding you that next week is our October meeting. So think of your questions in terms of computer hardware, because that's basically the topic. And the two speakers are from the Trailing Edge, which they specialize in older hardware, but I believe they sell some newer stuff too. So if you have any questions about computer hardware, next Wednesday is the time to bring them forward. However, that also means that there's no Q&A next week because it's a regular monthly meeting. So our next Q&A will be in 2 weeks, so that'll be October the 19th. So get your questions and shares ready and send them into suggestion box, and we'll make up a new agenda and have you front and center. Now, so that's it for me. Thanks very much, everyone. I hope you enjoyed all the different topics tonight, and we'll see you next week at the meeting and 2 weeks for the next QA.
Thanks, folks. See you next week.
Thank you.
So, Chris, did your computer chair come during the presentations?
No, it's not here yet. Well, I should go. Who knows? Maybe he just dropped at the front door. But he didn't ring the doorbell or knock on the door. But they said by end of day, it's supposed to be delivered. Who knows what that means?
Around here, I see a lot of deliveries where they'll just drop something off the door and take a photograph of it to prove they dropped it there.
Yeah.
And bugger off.
Yeah. I've seen that quite often as well, for sure.
Yeah, so. They don't need to talk. Better go check.
Yeah, I will. So as we're done here.
Stu, they don't hang around to take a picture of the guy that comes and steals the package?
Yeah.
Unless it's themselves.
Oh yeah, there's just some videos online with people like that.
Yeah, unfortunately. Okay, folks, we'll see you later.
Thanks. Bye,
everyone.
Night.